Random House Audio presents A Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick. Read for you by Paul Giamatti. Chapter 1. Once, a guy stood all day shaking bugs from his hair. The doctor told him there were no bugs in his hair. After taking a shower for 8 hours, standing under hot water hour after hour, suffering the pain of the bugs, he got out and dried himself, and he still had bugs in his hair. In fact, he had bugs all over him. A month later, he had bugs in his lungs. Having nothing else to do or think about, he began to work out theoretically the life cycle of the bugs, and with the aid of the Britannica, tried to determine specifically which bugs they were. They now filled his house. He read about many different kinds and finally noticed bugs outdoors, so he concluded they were aphids. After that decision came to his mind, it never changed, no matter what other people told him. Like, aphids don't bite people. They said that to him because the endless biting of the bugs kept him in torment. At the 7-Eleven grocery store, part of a chain spread out over most of California, he bought spray cans of Raid and Black Flag and Yard Guard. First he sprayed the house, and then himself. The Yard Guard seemed to work the best. As to the theoretical side, he perceived three stages in the cycle of the bugs. First, they were carried to him to contaminate him by what he called carrier people, which were people who didn't understand their role in distributing the bugs. During that stage, the bugs had no jaws or mandibles. He learned that word during his weeks of scholarly research. An unusually bookish occupation for a guy who worked at the handy brake and tire place relining people's brake drums. The carrier people, therefore, felt nothing. He used to sit in the far corner of his living room watching different carrier people enter, most of them people he'd known for a while, but some new to him, covered with the aphids in this particular non-biting stage. He'd sort of smile to himself because he knew that the person was being used by the bugs and wasn't hip to it. "What are you grinning about, Jerry?" they'd say. He'd just smile. In the next stage, the bugs grew wings or something, but they really weren't precisely wings. Anyhow, they were appendages of a functional sort permitting them to swarm, which was how they migrated and spread, especially to him. At that point, the air was full of them. It made his living room, his whole house, cloudy. During this stage, he tried not to inhale them. Most of all, he felt sorry for his dog, because he could see the bugs landing on and settling all over him and probably getting into the dog's lungs as they were in his own. Probably, at least so his empathic ability told him, the dog was suffering as much as he was. Should he give the dog away for the dog's own comfort? No, he decided. The dog was now inadvertently infected and would carry the bugs with him everywhere. Sometimes he stood in the shower with the dog, trying to wash the dog clean, too. He had no more success with him than he did with himself. It hurt to feel the dog suffer. He never stopped trying to help him. In some respect, this was the worst part, the suffering of the animal, who could not complain. "What the fuck are you doing in there all day in the shower with the goddamn dog?" his buddy Charles Freck asked one time, coming in during this. Jerry said, I gotta get the aphids off of him. He brought Max, the dog, out of the shower and began drying him. Charles Freck watched, mystified, as Jerry rubbed baby oil and talc into the dog's fur. All over the house, cans of insect spray, bottles of talc, and baby oil and skin conditioners were piled and tossed, most of them empty. He used many cans a day now.
I don't see any aphids, Charles said. What's an aphid?
It eventually kills you, Jerry said.
That's what an aphid is. They're in my hair and my skin and my lungs, and the goddamn pain is unbearable. I'm gonna have to go to the hospital. Well, how come I can't see them?
Jerry put down the dog, which was wrapped in a towel, and knelt over the shag rug.
I'll show you one, he said.
The rug was covered with aphids. They hopped up everywhere, up and down, some higher than others. He searched for an especially large one because of the difficulty people had seeing them.
Bring me a bottle or jar, he said. From under the sink. We'll cap it, put a lid on it, and then I can take it with me when I go to the doctor and he can analyze it.
Charles Freck brought him an empty mayonnaise jar. Jerry went on searching and at last came across an aphid leaping up at least 4 feet in the air. The aphid was over an inch long. He caught it, carried it to the jar, carefully dropped it in, and screwed on the lid. Then he held it up triumphantly. "See?" he said.
"Yeah," Charles Freck said, his eyes wide as he scrutinized the contents of the jar. "What a big one. Wow."
"Help me find more for the doctor to see," Jerry said, again squatting down on the rug, the jar beside him.
"Sure,"
Charles Freck said, and did so. Within half an hour, they had 3 jars full of the bugs. Charles, although new at it, found some of the largest. It was midday, in June of 1994, in California, in a tract area of cheap but durable plastic houses long ago vacated by the Straits. Jerry had at an earlier date sprayed metal paint over all the windows, though, to keep out the light. The illumination for the room came from a pole lamp into which he had screwed nothing but spot lamps, which shone day and night, so as to abolish time for him and his friends. He liked that. He liked to get rid of time. By doing that, he could concentrate on important things without interruption. Like this. 2 men kneeling down on the shag rug, finding bug after bug, and putting them into jar after jar.
"What do we get for these?" Charles Freck said later on in the day. "I mean, does the doctor pay a bounty or something? A prize? Any bread?"
"I get to help perfect a cure for them this way," Jerry said. The pain, constant as it was, had become unbearable. He'd never gotten used to it, and he knew he never would. The urge, the longing to take another shower was overwhelming him.
"Hey, man," he gasped, straightening up. "You go on putting him in jars while I take a leak and like that."
He started toward the bathroom.
"Okay,"
Charles said, his long legs wobbling as he swung toward a jar, both hands cupped. An ex-veteran, he still had good muscular control, though. He made it to the jar. But then he said suddenly,
"Jerry, hey, those bugs sort of scare me. I don't like it here by myself."
He stood up.
"Chicken shit bastard," Jerry said, panting with pain as he halted momentarily at the bathroom. "Couldn't you?"
"I got to take a leak." He slammed the door and spun the knobs of the shower. Water poured down.
"I'm afraid out here,"
Charles Freck's voice came dimly, even though he was evidently yelling loud.
"Then go fuck yourself,"
Jerry yelled back and stepped into the shower. What fucking good are friends? He asked himself bitterly. No good. No good. No fucking good.
"These fuckers sting,"
Charles yelled right at the door.
"Yeah, they sting," Jerry said as he rubbed shampoo into his hair. "That's what I thought."
A pause.
"Can I wash my hands and get them off and wait for you?"
Chicken shit, Jerry thought with bitter fury. He said nothing. He merely kept on washing.
That bastard wasn't worth answering.
He paid no attention to Charles Freck, only to himself, to his own vital, demanding, terrible, urgent needs. Everything else would have to wait. There was no time. No time. These things could not be postponed. Everything else was secondary. Except the dog. He wondered about Max, the dog. Charles Freck phoned up somebody who he hoped was holding.
"Can you lay about 10 deaths on me? Christ, I'm entirely out. I'm looking to score myself. And let me know when you find some. I could use some." "And what's wrong with the supply?" "Some busts, I guess."
Charles Freck hung up and then ran a fantasy number in his head as he slumped dismally back from the payphone booth. You never used your home phone for a buy call, to his parked Chevy. In his fantasy number, he was driving past the thrifty drugstore and they had a huge window display. Bottles of slow death, cans of slow death, jars and bathtubs and vats and bowls of slow death, millions of caps and tabs and hits of slow death mixed with speed and junk and barbiturates and psychedelics, everything. And a giant sign, "Your credit is good here." Not to mention, low, low prices, lowest in town. But in actuality, the thrifty usually had a display of nothing. Combs, bottles of mineral oil, spray cans of deodorant, always crap like that. But I bet the pharmacy in the back has slow death under lock and key in an unstepped-on, pure, unadulterated, uncut form, he thought as he drove from the parking lot onto Harbor Boulevard into the afternoon traffic. not a 50-pound bag. He wondered when and how they unloaded the 50-pound bag of Substance D at the Thrifty Pharmacy every morning, from wherever it came from. God knew, maybe from Switzerland, or maybe from another planet where some wise race lived. They'd deliver probably real early and with armed guards. The man standing there with laser rifles looking mean, the way the man always did. Anybody rip off my slow death, he thought through the man's head, I'll snuff them. Probably Substance D is an ingredient in every legal medication that's worth anything, he thought. A little pinch here and there according to the secret exclusive formula at the issuing house in Germany or Switzerland that invented it. But in actuality, he knew better. The authorities snuffed or sent up everybody selling or transporting or using. So in that case, the Thrifty drugstore, all the millions of Thrifty drugstores, would get shot or bombed out of business or anyhow fined. More likely just fined. The Thrifty had pull. Anyhow, how do you shoot a chain of big drugstores or put them away? And they just got ordinary stuff, he thought as he cruised along. He felt lousy because he only had 300 tabs of slow death left in his stash. Buried in his backyard under his camellia, the hybrid one with the cool big blossoms that didn't burn brown in the spring. I only got a week's supply, he thought. What then when I'm out? Shit. Suppose everybody in California and parts of Oregon runs out the same day, he thought. Wow. This was the all-time winning horror fantasy that he ran in his head, that every doper ran. The whole western part of the United States simultaneously running out and everybody crashing on the same day, probably about 6 a.m. Sunday morning, while the straights were getting dressed up to go to fucking pray. Scene. The First Episcopal Church of Pasadena at 8:30 a.m. on Crash Sunday. Holy parishioners, let us call on God now at this time to request his intervention in the agonies of those who are thrashing about on their beds withdrawing. Yeah, yeah, the congregation agreeing with the priest. But before he intervenes with a fresh supply of... A black and white evidently had noticed something in Charles Freck's driving he hadn't noticed. It had taken off from its parking spot and was moving along behind him in traffic, so far without lights or sirens, but... Maybe I'm weaving or something, he thought. Fucking goddamn fuzzmobile saw me fucking up. I wonder what. Cop. All right, what's your name? My name? Can't think of name. You don't know your own name? Cop signals to other cop in prowl car. This guy's really spaced. Don't shoot me here. Charles Freck and his horror fantasy number induced by the sight of the black and white pacing him. At least take me to the station house and shoot me there, out of sight. To survive in this fascist police state, he thought, you gotta always be able to come up with a name, your name, at all times. That's the first sign they look for that you're wired, not being able to figure out who the hell you are. What I'll do, he decided, is I'll pull off soon as I see a parking slot, pull off voluntarily before he flashes his light or does anything, and then when he glides up beside me, I'll say I got a loose wheel or something mechanical. They always think that's great, he thought, when you give up like that and can't go on. Like throwing yourself on the ground the way an animal does, exposing your soft, unprotected, defenseless underbelly. I'll do that, he thought. He did so, peeling off to the right and bumping the front wheels of his car against the curb. The cop car went on by. Pulled off for nothing, he thought. Now it'll be hard to back out again, traffic's so heavy. He shut off his engine. Maybe I'll just sit here parked for a while, he decided, and alpha meditate or go into various different altered states of consciousness, possibly by watching the chicks going along on foot. I wonder if they manufacture Bioscope for horny, rather than alpha. Horny waves, first very short, then longer, larger, larger, finally right off the scale. This is getting me nowhere, he realized. I should be out trying to locate someone holding. I gotta get my supply, or pretty soon I'll be freaking, and then I won't be able to do anything, even sit at the curb like I am. I not only won't know who I am, I won't even know where I am or what's happening. What is happening? He asked himself. What day is this? If I knew what day, I'd know everything else. And it'd seep back bit by bit. Wednesday, in downtown L.A., the Westwood section. Ahead, One of those giant shopping malls surrounded by a wall that you bounced off like a rubber ball, unless you had a credit card on you and passed in through the electronic hoop. Owning no credit card for any of the malls, it could depend only on verbal report as to what the shops were like inside. A whole bunch, evidently, selling good products to the straights, especially to the straight wives. He watched the uniformed armed guards at the mall gate checking out each person. Seeing that the man or woman matched his or her credit card and that it hadn't been ripped off, sold, bought, used fraudulently. Lots of people moved on in through the gate, but he figured many were no doubt window shopping. Not all that many people can have the bread or the urge to buy this time of day, he reflected. It's early, just past 2. At night, that was when. Shops all lit up. He could, all the brothers and sisters could, see the lights from without like showers of sparks, like a fun park for grown-up kids. Stores this side of the mall, requiring no credit card with no armed guards, didn't amount to much. Utility stores, a shoe and a TV shop, a bakery, small appliance repair, a laundromat. He watched a girl who wore a short plastic jacket and stretch pants wander along from store to store. She had nice hair, but he couldn't see her face, see if she was foxy. Not a bad figure, he thought. The girl stopped for a time at a window where leather goods were displayed. She was checking out a purse with tassels. He could see her peering, worrying, scheming on the purse. Bet she goes on in and requests to see it, he thought. The girl bopped on into the store as he had figured. Another girl amid the sidewalk traffic came along, this one in a frilly blouse, high heels, with silver hair and too much makeup. Trying to look older than she is, he thought. Probably not out of high school. After her came nothing worth mentioning, so he removed the string that held the glove compartment shut and got out a pack of cigarettes. He lit up and turned on the car radio to a rock station. Once he had owned a tape cartridge stereo, but finally, while loaded one day, he had neglected to bring it indoors with him when he locked up the car. Naturally, when he returned, the whole stereo tape system had been stolen. As would carelessness get you, he'd thought, and so now he had only the crummy radio. Someday, they'd take that too. But he knew where he could get another for almost nothing, used. Anyhow, the car stood to be wrecked any day. Its oil rings were shot and compression had dropped way down. Evidently, he had burned a valve on the freeway coming home one night with a whole bunch of good stuff. Sometimes when he'd really scored heavy, he got paranoid. Not about the cops so much as about some other heads ripping him off. Some head desperate from withdrawing and dingy as a motherfucker. A girl walked along now that made him take notice. Black hair, pretty, cruising slow. She wore an open midriff blouse and denim white pants, washed a lot. Hey, I know her, he thought. That's Bob Arctor's girl. That's Donna. He pushed open the car door and stepped out. The girl eyed him and continued on. He followed. And she thinks I'm fixing to grab ass, he thought as he snaked among the people. How easily she gained speed. He could barely see her now as she glanced back. A firm, calm face. He saw large eyes that appraised him, calculated his speed, and would he catch up? Not at this rate, he thought. She can really move. At the corner, people had halted for the sign to say walk instead of don't walk. Cars were making wild left turns. But the girl continued on, fast but with dignity, threading her path among the nutto cars. The drivers glared at her with indignation. She didn't appear to notice. Donna! When the sign flashed walk, he hurried to cross after her and caught up with her. She declined to run, but merely walked rapidly. Aren't you Bob's, old lady? He said. He managed to get in front of her to examine her face. No, she said. No. She came toward him, directly at him. He retreated backwards because she held a short knife pointed at his stomach. Get lost, she said, continuing to move forward without slowing or hesitating. Sure you are, he said. I met you at his place. He could hardly see the knife, only a tiny section of blade metal, but he knew it was there. She would stab him and walk on. The girl held the knife so well concealed that probably no one else, the others walking along, could notice. But he did. It was going right at him as she approached without hesitation. He stepped aside then, and the girl traveled on in silence.
Jeez, he said to the back of her. I know it's Donna, he thought. She just doesn't flash in who I am, that she knows me. Scared, I guess. Scared I'm gonna hustle her. You got to be careful, he thought. When you come to a strange chick on the street, they're all prepared now. Too much has happened to them. Funky little knife, he thought.
Chicks shouldn't carry those. Any guy could turn her wrist and the blade back on her any time he wanted. I could have, if I really wanted to get her.
He stood there feeling angry.
I know that was Donna, he thought.
As he started to go back toward his parked car, he realized that the girl had halted out of the movement of passers-by and now stood silently gazing at him. He walked cautiously toward her.
One night, he said, me and Bob and another chick had some old Simon and Garfunkel tapes, and you were sitting there.
She'd been filling capsules with high-grade death one by one, painstakingly, for over an hour. El primo, numero uno, death. After she had finished, she'd laid a cap on each of them, and they had dropped them, all of them together. Except her.
I just sell them, she had said. If I start dropping them, I eat up all my profits.
The girl said,
I thought you were going to knock me down and bang me. No, he said. I just wondered if you...
He hesitated.
Like, wanted a ride. On the sidewalk? He said, startled. In broad daylight?
Maybe in a doorway, or pull me into a car.
I know you, he protested. An Arctur would snuff me if I did that.
Well, I didn't recognize you. She came toward him three steps. I'm sort of nearsighted.
Oh, you ought to wear contacts.
She had, he thought, lovely, large, dark, warm eyes, which meant she wasn't on junk.
I did have, but one fell out in a punch bowl. Acid punch at a party. It sank to the bottom. I guess someone dipped it up and drank it. I hope it tasted good. It cost me $35 originally. You want a ride where you're going?
You'll bang me in the car.
No, he said. I can't get it on right now these last couple of weeks. It must be something they're adulterating all the stuff with, some chemical.
That's a neato line, but I've heard it before. Everybody bangs me. She amended that.
Tries to, anyhow. That's what it's like to be a chick. I'm suing one guy in court right now for molestation and assault. We're asking punitive damages in excess of $40,000. How far did he get?
Donna said, got his hand around my boob.
Well, that isn't worth $40,000.
Together they walked back toward his car.
You got anything to sell?
He asked.
I'm really hurting. I'm virtually out, in fact. Hell, I am out, come to think of it. Even a few, if you could spare a few.
I can get you some.
Tabs, he said. I don't shoot up.
Yes, she nodded intently, head down. But, see, they're real scarce right now. The supplies temporarily dried up. You probably discovered that already. I can't get you very many, but...
When? He broke in.
They'd reached his car. He halted, opened the door, got in. On the far side, Donna got in. They sat side by side. Day after tomorrow, Donna said. If I can get a hold of this guy, I think I can.
Shit, he thought. Day after tomorrow. No sooner, not like they... tonight?
Tomorrow at the earliest.
How much?
$60, $100.
Oh, jeez, he said. That's a burn.
They're super good. I've got them from them before. They're really not what you usually buy into. Take my word for it, they're worth it. Actually, I prefer to get them from him rather than from anybody else, when I can. He doesn't always have them. See, he just took a trip down south, I guess. He just got back. He picked them up himself, so I know they're good, for sure. And you don't have to pay me in advance when I get them, okay? I trust you.
I never front, he said.
Sometimes you have to.
Okay, he said. Then can you get me at least 100?
He tried to figure rapidly how many he could get. In 2 days, he could probably raise $120 and get 200 tabs from her. And if he ran across a better deal in the meantime from other people who were holding, he could forget her deal and buy from them. That was the advantage of never fronting. That plus never being burned. It's lucky for you that you ran into me, Donna said as he started up his car and backed out into traffic. I'm supposed to see this one dude in about an hour, and he'd probably take all I could get. He'd have been out of luck. This was your day. She smiled, and he did too.
I wish you could get him sooner, he said.
If I do,
Opening her purse, she got out a little notepad and a pen that had Sparks Battery Tune-Up stamped on it. How do I get a hold of you? And I forget your name.
Charles B. Freck, he said.
He told her his phone number. Not his, really, but the one he made use of at a straight friend's house for messages like this. And laboriously she wrote it down. What difficulty she had writing, he thought, peering and slowly scrawling.
They don't teach the chicks jack shit in school anymore, he thought. Flat out illiterate. But Foxy? So she can't hardly read or write, so what? What matters with a fox is nice tits.
I think I remember you, Donna said. Sort of. It's all hazy that night. I was really out of it. All I definitely remember was getting the powder into those little caps, Librium caps. We dumped the original contents. I must have dropped half. I mean, on the floor. She gazed at him meditatively as he drove.
You seem like a mellow dude, she said. And you'll be in the market later on? After a while, you'll want more?
Sure, he said. Wondering to himself if he could beat her price by the time he saw her again. He felt he could, most likely. Either way, he won. That is, either way, he scored. Happiness, he thought, is knowing you got some pills.
The day outside the car and all the busy people, the sunlight and activity streamed past unnoticed. He was happy. Look what he had found by chance, because, in fact, a black and white had accidentally paced him. An unexpected new supply of Substance D. What more could he ask out of life? He could probably now count on 2 weeks lying out of him, nearly half a month before he croaked, or nearly croaked. Withdrawing from Substance D made the two the same. 2 weeks! His heart soared, and he smelled for a moment, coming in from the open windows of the car, the brief excitement of spring.
Want to go with me to see Jerry Fabin? He asked the girl. I'm taking a load of his things over to him at the No. 3 Federal Clinic where they took him last night. I'm just carting over a little at a time, because there's a chance he might get back out, and I don't want to have to drag it all back.
I better not see him, Donna said.
You know him, Jerry Fabin?
Jerry Fabin thinks I contaminated him originally with those bugs.
Aphids?
Well, then he didn't know what they were. No, I better stay away. Last time I saw him, he got really hostile. It's his receptor sites in his brain, at least I think so. It seems like it, from what the government pamphlets say now.
That can't be restored, can it?
He said. No, Donna said, that's irreversible.
Well, the clinic people said they'd let me see him, and they said they believed he could work some, you know, he gestured. Not be,
Again he gestured. It was hard to find words for that, what he was trying to say about his friend. Glancing at him, Donna said, You don't have speech center damage, do you? In your, what is it called, occipital lobe?
No, he said, vigorously.
Do you have any kind of damage? She tapped her head.
Nah, it's just, you know, I have trouble saying it about those fucking clinics. I hate the neural aphasia clinics. One time I was there visiting a guy. He was trying to wax a floor. They said he couldn't wax a floor. I mean, he couldn't figure out how to do it. But what got me was he kept trying. I mean, not just for like an hour. He was still trying a month later when I came back. Just like he had been over and over again when I first saw him there, when I first went to visit him. He couldn't figure out why he couldn't get it right. I remember the look on his face. He was sure he'd get it right if he kept trying to flash on what he was doing wrong. What am I doing wrong? He kept asking him. There was no way to tell him. I mean, they told him. Hell, I told him. But he still couldn't figure it out.
The receptor sites in his brain or whatever, it usually goes first, Donna said placidly. Someone's brain, where he's gotten a bad hit or like that, like too heavy. She was watching the cars ahead.
Oh, look, there's one of those new Porsches with two engines, she pointed excitedly. Wow.
I knew a guy who hotwired one of those new Porsches, he said, and got it out on the Riverside Freeway and pushed it up to 175. Wipeout, he gestured. Right into the ass of a semi. Never saw it, I guess.
In his head, he ran a fantasy number, himself, at the wheel of a Porsche, but noticing the semi, all the semis, and everyone on the freeway, the Hollywood freeway at rush hour, noticing him. Noticing him for sure, a lanky, big-shouldered, good-looking dude in the new Porsche, going 200 miles an hour, and all the cops' faces hanging open helplessly.
"You're shaking," Donna said. She reached over and put her hand on his arm, a quiet hand that he had once responded to. "Slow down."
"I'm tired," he said. "I was up two nights and 2 days counting bugs, counting them and putting them in bottles. And finally, when we crashed and got up and got ready the next morning to put the bottles in the car to take to the doctor to show him there was nothing in the bottles. Empty."
He could feel the shaking now himself and see it in his hands on the wheel, the shaking hands on the steering wheel at 20 miles an hour.
"Every fucking one," he said. "Nothing, no bugs. And then I fucking realized it came to me about his brain, Jerry's brain."
The air no longer smelled of spring, and he thought, abruptly, that he urgently needed a hit of Substance D. It was later in the day than he had realized, or else he had taken less than he thought. Fortunately, he had his portable supply with him, in the glove compartment, way back. He began searching for a vacant parking slot to pull over.
"Your mind plays tricks," Donna said remotely. She seemed to have withdrawn into herself, gone far away. He wondered if his erratic driving was bumming her. Probably so.
Another fantasy film rolled suddenly into his head, without his consent. He saw first a big parked Pontiac with a bumper jack on the back of it that was slipping, and a kid around 13 with long thatched hair struggling to hold the car from rolling, meanwhile yelling for assistance. He saw himself and Jerry Fabin running out of the house together, Jerry's house, down the beer can littered driveway to the car. Himself, he grabbed at the car door on the driver's side to open it to stomp the brake pedal. But Jerry Fabin, wearing only his pants without even shoes, his hair all disarranged and streaming, he had been sleeping. Jerry ran past the car to the back and knocked, with his bare pale shoulder that never saw the light of day, the boy entirely away from the car. The jack bent and fell, the rear of the car crashed down, the tire and wheel rolled away, and the boy was okay.